This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. When it comes to keeping the water of Southwest Florida clean, how involved are you? On the second half of our show today, we'll talk with water experts who say the key to healthy waterways is starting small on the local ponds and man-made lakes that are a ground zero for chemicals and other contaminants entering our waterways. We'll talk about how you can make the right choices for healthy ponds and a way to take charge of water health in your area. But first, most patients regard the taking of certain medicines as a hit or miss. Sometimes they work for some people, sometimes not. And then they're prescribed a different one to see if it works better without further inquiry as to why. But scientists have been working on an answer to that question for years, and those in pharmacogenomics say it's all about your genetic makeup. Dr. Dan Handley is one of the doctors researching how genetics can impact a person's reaction to pharmaceuticals. He's with the Clinical and Translational Genome Research Institute and joins us in the studio today. Thank you for being here. One area in which the hit or miss phenomenon is most infamous is in psychotropic pharmaceuticals. So anyone who's faced depression or other conditions can attest finding the right medication is critical, but it's also time consuming and expensive. To avoid that, Fort Myers psychiatrist Dr. Robert Pollack uses genetic testing of his patients to quickly identify what will work best. Dr. Pollack is here with us in the studio today, too. Thank you for being here. We are talking about genetic testing to determine the correct medication to treat illnesses and other issues. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag of GCL. First, Dr. Robert Pollack, when did you first hear about a genetic link to the effectiveness of medication for psychological cases?
About as far back as I can go with practicing. We always knew that there were patterns. We used to call them psychopharmacogenetics, when we knew that people in the same family often responded the same way. We didn't have the technology. The technology came along later. Approximately 15 years ago, we started seeing the technology coming out, which allowed us to take a look at the P450 oxidase and cytochrome systems, which could assist us in matching a person's profile with the component parts of the medications that are necessary for treatment.
So before genetic information to ID this the right kind of medicine, how long would it usually take someone to find the right drug? Say someone comes in with a case of depression that they're working through, and you try a drug and then you try another one to make sure to see which one works best for them.
Anywhere from 3 to 7 medication changes.
And how long does each medication take? I mean, so do you have to be on it for a week or 2 weeks?
Approximately 3 to 5 weeks.
So that's a few months, several months out.
That's correct.
And then how expensive are these different medications?
Medicines go anywhere from $30 for a month's supply to $250 to $800.
So by being able to genetically identify what their body is going to react best to, that gets them the right medication more quickly?
That's correct.
And then what are the other risk factors, you know, when you have somebody dealing with depression and they can't seem to find the right thing?
Actually, increased frustration, increasing depression. Certain people get anhedonic. They want to die. Suicidal ideation starts coming up. There's no hope for me. We have all these pills, but I can't take them.
Yeah, nothing works for me. And then they kind of still feel like even worse about themselves.
Correct.
So when did you start using this genetic testing?
excuse me, in clinical practice approximately 8 years ago.
About 8 years ago. So it's kind of been around.
Yes.
Well, then you're before the cutting edge. You're like ahead of it.
I come from a long line of pharmacology-oriented physicians.
Well, you mentioned that you have a history of what was it, penicillin?
My father worked with Alexander Fleming on penicillin in 1930.
So you're about looking forward to the next new thing and making sure it's tested out right. So Dr. Dan Handley, what do genetics have to do with how a person responds to a drug?
Well, as we know, we're all genetically different, right? So we have different appearance, hair color, eye color. All of these things are a matter of our genetics. Well, the same thing is true for the biochemical pathways in our body that are responsible for drug metabolism and drug response. So the genes that encode the proteins that are involved with how a drug interacts with your body can vary between different individuals. So because of our unique genetics, a drug might work differently in you versus me.
So, for example, what happens to a pill when you take it? I mean, I'm not a doctor, so I think it's kind of magic. I don't really know. But when you take that pill, it is now being broken down in your body, and everybody mm-hmm. breaks it down in different ways?
Right. So when you take a medication, what happens is it's absorbed usually in the small intestine. There are molecules, proteins that are involved with transporting the drug into your blood system. Your liver and small intestine is actually trying to get rid of the drug. So the drugs are being metabolized, usually oxidized by different enzymes that are encoded by genes. And that's the reason you have to take multiple doses of a drug. So because your body is always trying to get rid of it. So your blood concentration goes up when you take a drug to a point, and then it starts tapering off. So you have to keep taking repeated doses because there are enzymes breaking these drugs down.
So this genetic research is finding that people with different – this type of genetic situation, they have these kinds of proteins and these kinds of enzymes that break down different drugs in different ways?
Right. So there's a number of enzymes. They're called the cytochrome P450s, but there are a number of enzymes, primarily six for most drugs that are responsible for metabolizing drugs. And the genetic code for those actually differ between us. In fact, some people have multiple copies of some of these enzyme genes. So if you have multiple copies or if you have a variant of the gene that produces an overactive enzyme, you'll metabolize the drug much more quickly. And conversely, you might actually have a genetic mutation that causes the enzyme produced by that gene to be inactive. So now you're not even metabolizing or you're metabolizing the drug very slowly. So what you're trying to do generally with pharmacology, with taking medication, is if the blood level of the drug goes too high, you're in the toxic range and you're at risk for adverse side effects. There's a lower level where if the blood level doesn't go high enough, you're not even getting a therapeutic effect.
Yeah, so you got to hit that window right in the middle.
So you got to get in that therapeutic range. And so that's the goal of pharmacotherapy, is to try to keep drug levels within that range. Well, when you have so much genetic variability in the enzymes that are responsible for metabolizing the drugs, you could have an ultra-rapid metabolizer that they're giving in a normal dose of a drug. It's being eliminated from the body so quickly it never reaches a therapeutic effect. And conversely, if you have overactive enzymes because of your genetics or underactive, if you don't have any activity, you could actually have very high levels of the drug in your body and you can actually have adverse side effects.
So using like an analogy, if you're looking at a baseball strike zone, you're trying to get it not too high, not too low. You're trying to get it in the strike zone, but you have different batters. So genetically, you have people with different places where that zone's at.
Right. And prior to
super simplified.
Right. And prior to pharmacogenomics, physicians don't have any guidance except trial and error and their own experience. So a lot of drugs
– and they would go on what they consider to be the average.
Right. So a lot of drugs are different categories. So for antidepressants, there's several couple dozen antidepressants that you can use. And unless you have some sort of guidance, and what does a physician do? I mean, the psychiatrist here can tell you, you know, how they approach it traditionally. A lot of physicians for any kind of medication, what they do is what I've given my previous patients. They're going on their own experience.
Yeah, based on experience and what other people react.
And come back in 3 weeks and see how you're doing and try to adjust the dose. It's not working. Let's try a different drug. Well, now a lot of those questions can be answered ahead of time by doing the genetic profiling. And now you can narrow that list of drugs down from two dozen to maybe there's some that you probably shouldn't take. There's some that probably wouldn't give you a therapeutic effect, but maybe there's just two or three that are more optimal for you because of your personal genetics.
So Dr. Pollack, how has been the success rate? You said you've been doing this for 8 years. I mean, and before that, you didn't have this kind of genetic testing that you could do.
Correct.
You know, clinically, how have the results been?
Well, let's start with the average number of medications that a patient takes to get to the point of remission, which is really what you want. Where let's assume that seven was about the average of what you would see. We tend to see somewhere between two and three. It's unusual for us to go and change more than twice. Mm-hmm. So that cuts down time of illness. That cuts down degree of disability. That allows people to go back home, back to their families. My patient population basically works. So they work for a living and their caregivers, their parents, their children. So it has been a phenomenal event. The amount of money that is saved, if you want to look at it from that standpoint, is they see me much less. Insurance companies should really like me because our average number of visits per patient has dropped drastically with the use of these.
With the use of this kind of genetic testing?
Yes, ma'am.
So I wanted to ask, we brought up the insurance people who we all love to deal with. I wanted to ask, are there any things that can be found in this kind of genetic testing that could come up as a flag to an insurance company that they could potentially hold against you?
Actually, it's the opposite. I would rather an insurance company have this information because it will tell them that the medicine that I'm using is most efficacious for the patients at the proper cost. Insurance companies primarily are interested in saving money. Taking care of patients is not in the top five. So if we take a look at this and say, listen, we have this information. This is what it means. Therefore, a generic drug of $20 is really not a valuable as opposed to the other one of $150. So let's go ahead and use this, get the patient better, stop the multiple trials, stop the requirements, stop the tiers of different medicines you have to try, and treat patients like people. Treat patients based on their genetics, based on their illness, and based on the medications, and stop assuming that you can tell people how to practice medicine by cost. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to also ask Dr. Handley, are there other applications? And we're talking about the psychological medications. And do you see anything down the road also with applications towards cancer treatment and those kinds of drugs, which are very expensive?
Right. Certainly, any condition that's treated by a pharmaceutical, pharmacogenomics will play a role. So it spans pretty much every discipline of medicine. So whether it's cardiology or transplant, anything. But certainly cancer is one of those that's important in pharmacogenomics because a lot of these cancer therapies are very expensive. And you're also – if you're giving the wrong cancer chemotherapy, you're wasting precious time if it's not going to work for a patient. Because you don't want to be giving the patient the wrong medication for a month or two only to find out it's not working. You'd rather know ahead of time whether it's going to work or not, or more likely. So doing a genetic profile ahead of time would potentially save cost because of these very expensive medications and save lives because now you're giving a better medication and not wasting time with doing the trial and error approach.
And a better prognosis in that it may not then go to stage 3 or 4.
Exactly.
I mean, if you can stop it in its tracks faster than trying to do the trial and error like
exactly.
You're talking about. Do you know, are there any doctors that are practicing, that are oncologists that are using any of this type of genetic profiling?
We've been discussing doing some projects with some of the oncologists in the region. I'm not aware that they're specifically using this, but but that's one of the things as a research institute that we would like to start instituting in this region in Southwest Florida.
So the FDA has started recommending genetic testing in a couple of instances. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Right. Even on the FDA website, they have a list of drugs and suggested genetic tests prior for the doctor prescribing the drug. So even the FDA is behind this. They see that this is very valuable.
So now how then do the doctors come to understand how it works? Does the FDA explain it to them or is it explained to them by the private organizations that do this type of genetic testing?
Well, this is an area that we're trying to be very active in is getting the word out to the physicians because we have a psychiatrist here who's cutting edge, who understands it, who gets it, is very comfortable. But many physicians haven't been taught about this. They were never taught about this in medical school. Their first exposure to it is a patient coming in with a report from one of these companies that the doctor didn't even order. And mm-hmm. So the doctor is expected to interpret this report that the patient brings in. The doctor is bewildered, right? So we need to get out to more of the physicians and explain what this is about. It's really all upside. There's really very little downside to having a pharmacogenomic test done. So there's no reason it shouldn't be done routinely.
Well, and it's not like the FDA is not conservative. I mean, they aren't known to be on the cutting edge of the newest science. So, I mean, the fact that they're promoting using this kind of genetic testing for at least a couple of things indicates that there is some validity.
Well, yeah, there's quite a bit of data. So we're in a position now where there's a lot of data that's collected that makes pharmacogenomics usable today. But there's a wide expanse. There's a lot more research that needs to be done. And that's what we're trying to do is expand the number of drugs and number of genes that we can look at to improve the information.
Mm-hmm.
And also we're looking at the economics as well because we realize that insurance companies need to see hard data. You just can't say in theory it's going to lower costs. They want to see the numbers. So as an add-on to our research projects, we're also looking at how much does it save the health system? How much does it save the patient?
So you have to be an economist as well as a doctor.
So yeah, we consult with economists as well and statisticians to run that because you can have all the science in the world, but you need to do the economics as well to try to get this accepted widely.
Yeah, you got to sell it, right?
Right.
We are talking about genetic testing to determine what prescriptions will work based on a person's individual makeup. Do you have a question or a comment? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now, just a few months ago, the General Services Administration, which is the U.S. Office for Procurement, has now made genetic testing for veterans and military personnel a reimbursable expense because of its efficiency in identifying drugs for PTSD. Now, Dr. Robert Pollack is a psychiatrist with a specialization in PTSD. Tell me about the importance of quickly getting medication to people who have experienced trauma.
PTSD is a really interesting phenomenon because we're looking at an external event that triggers off a mutation. It's called a single nucleotide polymorphism, or a SNP, which basically can change the way a gene presents itself, and you can have somebody suddenly have a depressive illness as a result of an emotional trauma, whether it's child abuse, whether it's shootings. We started seeing some stuff after the World Trade Center when one group of people, because they didn't know what to do, got a small dose of an antidepressant and the others didn't. The ones who didn't all went through counseling, and they stayed ill. They continued to suffer PTSD. Those that got medication before treatment, but right after the Trade Center, actually did much better. So this is sort of the beginning, and it's like translational psychiatry. So we're talking about the impact of the environment on genes. So what I had the opportunity to do about a year ago, which is unfortunate to call it an opportunity, we had the Pulse shootings up in Orlando. We had survivors. We had first responders working in conjunction with University of Central Florida Restores Program, which works specifically on PTSD. I went up there and helped them evaluate them. The question is, how can we get the proper kinds of treatment in place quickly, effectively, efficiently, and cost effectively? So they have their program about confrontational therapy, looking for cues and goals. I had the opportunity to be able to do genome testing on all of them. It was a company called Genomine that went in there and gave us 50 tests free to treat these kids. And in about 5 days, I had a profile. I could get them treated a lot more quickly. In addition to that, I managed to get a couple of pharmaceutical companies, with a little twisting, to give us the medicines that were indicated on most of these. And we had very, very good results with our first responders. So because when PTSD goes on longer, then the changes in the genomics get harder and harder to deal with. Then the medication is not as efficacious, and you have to look at alternative treatments, ketamine infusions and other things like that.
So you're saying that if someone is exposed to trauma, it causes a physical change.
It can cause a physical
change. It can. It doesn't to everybody.
No.
And it's kind of hard to determine who it's going to hit.
Well,
and who it's
interesting
not.
Enough, one of the gene tests that we do is the SLC6A4. And when it has an allele, an SS allele, these people tend to be more prone to PTSD events and symptoms than others. So it's sort of interesting to watch that. It was brought up to some law enforcement agents that it may be a good idea to pre-screen people. The unions went nuts and a couple of other people. But it is a value to know who really is prone to that. And that SS allele, as we screen people going into PTSD programs and I see that, I know exactly where I'm going to have to go, how I'm going to have to treat these people, and I get these people better faster.
So How receptive were the people there after the Pulse shooting to being tested and going on medication before they felt like they had an issue?
Wide open. They said, help us. Yeah. It's just about a year now. It was an awful event. And the first responders and the survivors and some of the people who plane out were heroes who just didn't understand why they don't feel well. What's wrong? There's a YouTube video called You Ruined Me, R-U-I-N-E-D, which is about the impact of child abuse on SNPs and genetic presentation. Magnificent little 2.5-minute video. Puts it right there on the table.
Yeah, it gives you like a more it's a graphic illustration, like kind of illustrated over the video. And I saw that video, and it kind of makes it make a little bit more sense. It's so kind of hard to discuss because psychologically we always think a chemical imbalance is what we were told all the time. There's a chemical issue, but it seems like it's not so much chemical. It's more of a physical difference.
And when you get veterans, when I get police officers, when I get firefighters, the ability for us to get them into treatment faster – it is right on top. I mean, you save lives, you change lives. And that's what this is all about. This is about identifying an illness, diagnosing it, coming up with the best way to treat them and do this. This is about taking care of people. It's about putting the right treatment in front of them. And, you know, the economics are silly when you look at it. You know, the tests are not astronomical in cost. And most of the companies that do them have patient assistant programs, and they're down. They should be a tenth of what they charge.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask also, Dr. Handley, there have been genetic tests done that determine the correct strength and dosage. We talked about that, you know, the strike zone where you want to get it in that kind of a dosage. Is there any impact are there any studies that are showing that some people are maybe physically more susceptible to the effects of things like opiates, for example, that could get them into an addiction problem? Because not everybody that takes an opiate ends up becoming an addict.
Yes, and that's one of the areas, an active areas of research is looking into that, who's more prone to being addicted versus other people. And there's a lot of biochemical reasons why that might be. And there's also reasons why some people don't get pain relief from a medication. So let's say that – so when you take an opioid drug, it goes to a receptor that helps alleviate the pain. Well, that receptor is a protein encoded by a gene. And if you have a mutated version of that receptor, it has a different shape. So the opioid's not going to even give you the relief. So this kind of testing is very important for pain relief because you have this two sides of the opioid problem. One is – you genuinely have people in pain and you want to be able to treat that pain. And then you have the potential for abuse and you don't want to get people addicted or have people abuse the drug. And the other part of this is, again, when you're looking at metabolism rates, that some people may metabolize an opioid very quickly. And so they're not getting very much pain relief. Other people might be normal and some people might be very slow metabolizers. So now – as it is, when a patient comes back to the physician and says, I need a refill on my drugs, the physician has no idea whether the person's abusing the drug or whether they're really not getting pain relief. If you actually do the genetic test, then you have some guidance. You have a better idea. If they're a very fast metabolizer for the drug, you have a better idea of why they're coming back.
Looking for a refill sooner than the
right,
other guy.
Right, so they actually legitimately need the refills more frequently than the other people. So it can help. It's not completely black and white, but it can help the physician distinguish between someone who genuinely needs the medication refilled more often versus someone that they might suspect is addicted to the drug.
Or it might also tip him off on the guy that's looking for the refills more often. He really doesn't need it so much too. So it could work in the opposite direction in that, you know, somebody is looking for refills more frequently, reporting pain when you can tell by their genetics that they should be responding better.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So it seems really groundbreaking to someone who's not been studying this for years, like both of you have. But where does the research go from here? I mean, do you see this becoming something that everybody just kind of has in their back pocket, like their blood type? Like, I'm blood type AB negative and so I'm also genomic type F, and so therefore this class of drugs doesn't do anything for me, but this one does. Do you see that being part of the future?
Every one of my patients that gets this testing, we go through it, and they carry it with them, and I show, Whenever you get a medication, you take a look at the pharmacology of that medication. You take a look at the cytochromes and you take a look if that medicine is appropriate for the cytochrome structure that you have. And maybe this is a wrong medicine for you. Go and share that with your cardiologist. Show it with your internist. And it makes the doctors smarter because they have to respond to the patient's requests. Simple example, I had shoulder surgery. They had a particular anesthetic that they wanted. I have a terrible 2D6 profile, which they would laugh at. And I have, you know, one of my arms doesn't do anything and the other one is about 30% active. So that's probably a bad drug for me to use for my shoulder. Why don't we change it? And it makes a difference. It's a very practical event.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this being something that – I mean, our drugs are already classified as far as what they have and what they do. Is there anything right. more that needs to be known about a drug in order to understand how it applies to different genetic profiles?
Well, there's a number of gene-drug interactions that are known that have been studied. And there's also a wide variety of the quality of the literature that's been published. So there's a lot of research that still needs to be done. So – we want to identify new genes that have previously not been discovered that are involved with drug response. We want to start looking at the genes that we do know about that are involved with drug response and expand that to more drugs and more classes of drugs. There's a lot of research there. We want to, again, look at the economics and be able to prove that by taking a pharmacogenomics test, which isn't very expensive, and you really just have to take it once. So we want to get that out. To try to get this really more widespread, the other thing is reaching out to the public so the public understands this, reaching out to more physicians so that they understand this better.
How does that get organized to reach out to all the physicians that are out there to get them to understand it?
Well, it's difficult, but you know, workshops, physicians need to have continuing education. So we're trying to push for more of that, some more educational materials. We're also developing curriculum for not only physicians but other healthcare providers. So pharmacists should be aware of this as well because this is transforming pharmacology.
Do you feel like physicians might be incentivized also by being able to be more accurate with their treatment of patients?
You would think so. One of the problems that you have with physicians, and myself included, we have a degree of narcissism that we bring with us. It's what allows you to make life and death decisions. And then so somebody comes to you with a test and you go, well, you know, my judgment is pretty good and it's hard to move somebody off that spot. And so you have to go in there, and the errors that they make in these companies that test is they sell it the wrong way. Instead of saying, fine, let's say you want to use drug A. Okay, that's your choice. Now let's take a look at what the profile is. If you use that based on this, you have to use three times the dose, which may also have three times the side effects, or you can use this other medication, which is comparable and probably give you something better. Most doctors will respond to this and say, oh, wow, that's really good. I want to treat my patients, but you're not telling me what to do. Doctors are pushed right now by every insurance company under the sun to do this. You have to be able to make that decision. That's part of your ego. That's part of what makes you a professional. But that has to be put in front of them, and there has to be a strong enough lobby that allows medical care to be done based on the medical necessities, based on the genetics, based on the medicines that's needed. It's also a way of debunking myths that get out there. A lot of people think – let's just pick folic acid. I'm not going to dump on it. But people say folic acid cures depression. No, only if you have an MTHFR gene and you have an anomalous situation there, and then maybe you have to supplement it so it can metabolize folic acid and get your serotonin going, and then you can get treated more effectively. So the more information you have, the more these other things just sort of go out the window. It's about information. It's about valuable information. It's about information that comes to people that are pure clinicians that need it, that aren't interested in the other part.
And this is the kind of information that's real easy to fly right over somebody's head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of tough, and nobody really likes to feel like they don't get it.
In my office, I have a great big glass whiteboard, and it's got drawings on it, and every one of my patients knows exactly what medicine they take, what it does, how it functions, why we have to change it, and where we're going.
We have a call coming in from Amy in Fort Myers who has a comment. What would you like to say, Amy?
Well, I just wanted to let you know that my daughter had this exact testing done by one of her doctors, and it was a godsend. Within just a matter of 1 or 1.5 weeks, it narrowed down which medications to put her on, something that would have taken, you know, quite some time with the doctor, you know, testing out different doses and seeing what might work. And within just a matter of 1.5 weeks, he had all of the information in front of him. So I want to let you know everything that those gentlemen were saying was right on target.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in and sharing that with us, Amy. That's really interesting. Now, if somebody is, you know, a patient, how do they go about getting this type of genetic testing, or do they need to talk to their doctor about it and convince their doctor to order it?
Since the doctors don't make any money on it, it's a question of if you want the test done, it's a simple – it's a buccal smear. Take two swabs, put it inside your cheek. It
like
goes
out. Like a Q-tip in the cheek.
Mm-hmm, and it goes out to the laboratory of that particular company. We get the results back in 3 to 5, 6 days.
Mm-hmm. And so the doctor is the one that has to order it. I mean, he's probably the only one that's going to be able to translate it anyway. I mean,
well, there's a transition. There are companies that are trying to go direct to consumer. So it's a little bit chaotic right now until things get sorted out. Mm-hmm. It's most companies require a physician to order the test. So there's kind of a triangle there. You have to talk to your physician. The physician has to talk to the company about getting the test done. So it's a little bit cumbersome now, but that should iron out.
And then you got to find out if your insurance is going to cover it or not. If the insurance doesn't cover it, what is the average out-of-pocket for some of these kinds of tests?
Right now you're looking at approximately $1,700. Most companies have a patient assistance program based on your income, and you end up paying about $150, somewhere between $75 and $150. Everybody is aware of the fact that it's high.
Mm-hmm. And the price is coming down as the technology improves. Mm-hmm. So there are tests. It's wide-ranging depending on how many genes you get tested and the methodology they use to test, whether it's looking for just single-point mutations or whether you're sequencing entire regions of genes that give you more information. But some of these tests are down, getting down to even just list-priced $500, $400, $300. Some down to $100.
Kind of so depends on the place.
It depends on the place and the
quality. I wonder if it's a get-what-you-pay-for situation, though.
Exactly.
It would make me kind of suspicious.
It is. Mm-hmm. And there are companies popping up all the time now to do this type of testing.
We had one company that went and said that we have the 11 genetic markers for depression. If you have 7 of the 11, you're depressed. So I don't know. If I ask somebody if they're depressed, they say yes. I don't think I need the test. And the markers are actually in triple digits, and how they chose those 11, they're out of business now, by the way.
Oh, yes. There are some people that are shady sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and they're out. They're gone. But, people will jump on it, and it's really the job of – from my standpoint, it's my job to make sure that my patients get the proper testing so that they get the proper medicine.
It's the job of the physician to also vet and make sure that they're using the best kind of lab to make sure that their patient isn't wasting their money.
Absolutely.
Right? Well, we're going to have to leave it there today, but I want to thank our guests. This has been really an intriguing segment. I really enjoyed doing this one. So thank you to our guest, Dr. Robert Pollack of Fort Myers, psychiatrist and doctor, also Dr. Dan Handley with the Clinical and Translational Genome Research Institute. We have links to your research and websites available on WGCUnews.org. So if anybody would like any more information, they can go there and check it out. But thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, how clean is the water in your neighborhood? We'll talk with two local experts who say the key to clean and healthy waterways in Southwest Florida starts with that man-made pond that you may be able to see right out your window. But how can you get involved in keeping that water clean? We'll have answers coming up next. I'm Julie Glenn, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.
Mary has a blue-eyed mother. Turns out Mary